Let me pray. Father, thank you for this evening, and we do thank you for Hosea and the words that you have spoken through him. Lord, I pray that your spirit would fill this space, that we would be able to feel your presence and understand that you want to engage with us through Hosea, through these words. And this evening, Lord, I pray specifically that you would reveal to us a word or a phrase, an idea, something it is that you want for each of us to pay attention to, pause, reflect on, reconsider, understand in a different way. Lord, we know that you want to engage with us in this way, and we trust you in this space. We trust you with our hearts and our minds. Just reveal to us what it is that you would want us to pay attention to and understand more deeply in order to have a more full understanding of what it is that you desire for us in our relationship with you. And we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, Hosea chapter 4. If you're in a blue Bible, it's on page 752. Hear the word of the Lord, O children of Israel, for the Lord has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land. There is no faithfulness or steadfast love and no knowledge of God in the land. There is swearing, lying, murder, stealing, and committing adultery. They break all bounds, and the bloodshed follows bloodshed. Therefore, the land mourns, and all who dwell in it languish, and also the beasts of the field and the birds of the heavens and even the fish of the sea are taken away. Yet let no one contend, and let none accuse, for with you is my contention, O priest. You shall stumble by day, the prophet shall stumble with you by night, and I will destroy your mother. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I reject you from being a priest to me. And since you have forgotten the law of your God, I also will forget your children. The more they increased, the more they sinned against me. I will change their glory into shame. They feed on the sin of my people. They are greedy for their iniquity. And it shall be like people like priest. I shall punish them for all their way for their ways and repay them for their deeds. They shall eat, but not be satisfied. They shall play the whore, but not multiply. Because they have forsaken the Lord to cherish whoredom, wine, and new wine, which take away the understanding. My people inquire of a piece of wood. And their walking staff gives them oracles. For a spirit of whoredom has led them astray, and they have left their God to play the whore. They sacrifice on the top of mountains and burn offerings on the hills under oak, poplar, terebinth, because their shade is good. Therefore, your daughters play the whore, and your brides commit adultery. I will not punish your daughters when they play the whore, nor your brides when they commit adultery. For the men themselves go aside with prostitutes and sacrifice with cult prostitutes, and a people without understanding shall come to ruin. Though you play the whore, O Israel, let not Judah become guilty. Enter not into Gilgal, nor go up to Bethaven, and swear not as the Lord lives. Like a stubborn heifer, Israel is stubborn. Can the Lord now feed them like a lamb in a broad pasture? Ephraim is joined to idols. Leave him alone. When their drink is gone, they give themselves to whoring. Their rulers dearly love shame. A wind has wrapped them in its wings, and they shall be ashamed because of their sacrifices. Okay. Some context before we move forward. One of the things is in chapters 1-3, God is using, as we know, this, he's using the marriage of Hosea and Gomer as an analogy for a covenant relationship, because that's what a marriage is. And he's using that relationship as an analogy for his relationship, his covenant relationship with Israel, okay? So we have that context, and we have to keep that in mind. In chapters 1 and 3, we saw this pattern occur, and in chapter 3 or 2, we saw it play out through the whole thing. But there was this pattern of accusation of sin, and then an explanation or a threat of the consequence or the discipline or the punishment or the judgment that was coming. And then after that, there was this hope that was given, the hope of restoration of this relationship. So we see this pattern. We saw it in chapters 1-3. And now starting in chapter 4-11, we're not going to see such a tight pattern. In fact, starting in this chapter 4 and through chapter 11, it's going to feel like we're pushed up against the wall, like Israel's pushed up against the wall and God's not going to let down. And so in order for us to understand and stick with it, we have to keep the context for ourselves, right, of the marriage analogy, because Gomer is not going to be mentioned again. Okay, so we have to keep that in the forefront. So the language that comes in regards to whoredom and prostitution and sexual sin, we have to draw back to the analogy of Gomer and Hosea's marriage. Okay, so imagine if somebody were to pluck something out of chapters 4-11 of Hosea, not having read chapters 1-3. What do you do with that? So it's really important. I mean, a couple of things. For us in this with Hosea, it's super important. But even beyond Hosea, I hope that this is an example of why it is so critical that we get the full context of whatever it is that we're taking out, whether it's one verse or one chapter or a section. Okay, because if we don't have the context of chapters 1-3 in Hosea, I don't know what we would do with the rest of chapters 4-11. Okay, so we need to keep that in context. And then we need to just hold on to that hope that we saw in chapters 1-3, that hope for restoration. It's coming and it's there, and we'll see little tiny peaks of it, but it won't necessarily be fully explained and illustrated the way that we saw it in the previous three chapters. And so we have to hold on to that for ourselves as we go through these next few chapters. So right away, again, in the very first verse, it says, "Hear the word of the Lord," which tells us that this is God's message through Hosea, okay? And it sets a tone. This is poetic, but it is setting a tone. We've already got this tone, right? It's strong, it's forceful language, and we're going to see it in a little bit different light, because right away he says, "O children of Israel, for the Lord has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land." A controversy is language that would be used for like a covenant dispute or like a covenant lawsuit. So God is bringing charges against Israel, saying, we're in this covenant relationship, and you're not following the agreements of the covenant, the laws, the expectations. And I'm going to tell you what it is that I am charging you with. And we have to remember that God is the prosecutor, right? And the judge. So what we're going to see is kind of, we'll see this language or this flavor of maybe some a legal argument. Okay? So he goes on and he is going to tell them what he sees and what the problem is. There is no faithfulness or steadfast love and no knowledge of God in the land. At first, I was like, okay, makes sense. And I was gonna, and then I moved on. There is swearing, lying, murder, stealing, committing adultery. And I'm like, check. Yep, no, don't do that. Don't do that. So I started using it as this checklist, but then I kept being drawn back. So in my dwelling, I was drawn back to these phrases, no faithfulness or steadfast love, no knowledge. And so I wanted to do a little bit more digging and understanding, because I think faithfulness and faith, like I'm faithful, it's a word that we just skip over and use because we're supposed to. And so I wanted to dig in a little bit deeper about what faithfulness looks like, because we know God is faithful. And if God is our model of faithfulness, we should probably know what that actually means. So thinking of faithfulness as truth, okay? It describes a firmness in a people's commitment, a reliability in their responsibilities, and an honesty about what they say. There is no deception. So faithfulness as truth, commitment, reliability, faithfulness. I think sometimes we just use the word faithfulness so quickly and so flippantly. It's important to remember faithfulness, and God is faithful. And what does faithfulness look like when we see it in and through God? It's truth. It's commitment. It is reliability to his responsibilities to us and his covenant people. And it's honesty. And there is no deception. That's what faithfulness is. And then he goes on and he says, there's no steadfast love. Well, within a covenant, this kind of love would be a compassionate type of love, an attitude of maintaining a relationship, like a commitment, right? Steadfast love is a commitment to not the love, but the person. And we also think about steadfast love. We have heard John talk about this on Sunday mornings, and Eric up here, this idea of hesed love, that is a covenantal kind of love. It's not a feeling, okay? It's an action. And people who are in a covenant relationship and are expressing steadfast love express their emotional heart connection to the one that they love by their actions and their words, right? So we are not, our actions are not going to violate the words that we say. Okay, well, if I say that I love Steve, I mean, I do. Not, I don't mean like if I said I did, because I do. If I tell Steve I love him every day, and then I am constantly badgering him and telling him that he, you don't bring enough money home, you never clean up the bathroom. These are all hypothetical. Maybe not the bathroom one. But he does clean more toilets than I've ever cleaned in our married life. Yes, that's the truth. But if I say to him, I love him, and if I say to you, I love him, and then you hear me badmouth him, complain about him, cut him down, my words don't match, okay? If I am not moving towards Steve in my relationship and I'm moving away from him, that would be communicating something other than what my words say in loving him. Okay? So steadfast love is moving toward. God exhibits and models steadfast love for us. Words and actions express the love, and they're consistent. Remember a few weeks ago when we talked about what happens in a relationship when there's disappointment, dissatisfaction, and then you start to see a displacement of affection and the dissolving of a relationship. In steadfast love, that does not happen. And then we have this accusation of not knowing God, okay? And we're going to see this three times. I circled it three times. We see it here in verse 1, and we see it two more times in verse 6. And so this knowledge, in this context, knowledge is thought of in two different ways. One is this objective knowledge, like we know the truths about who God is. We know what he wants from us in our relationship, right? So in this context, it means if these people know God, the objective part of knowing God would mean they know the laws that he gave them, okay? That would be an objective knowledge of the covenant relationship and an understanding of who God is and what he desires from us and what he has given us, okay? That is an understanding, an objective understanding. A subjective understanding is not knowledge-based like we think about it, like right knowledge or knowing the right thing, okay? We talked about this. I talk about this a lot, and John has talked about it. So orthodoxy, right knowledge, or right understanding, okay? It's not just that, but that is a part of this knowledge that he is saying it doesn't exist, okay? This idea of orthopraxy, the right action comes from the knowledge. Subjective knowledge is relational, a deeper level of understanding, a heart type of knowledge. And that's also part of this. And we'll talk a little bit about that again. So he goes on and he's saying, no faithfulness, no steadfast love, no knowledge. And what's interesting is that these are sins of omission. These things are absent. He's saying these are absent, which is an omission. And he's acknowledging and he's pointing out, and the accusation is about the sin. He's identifying what it is. Then he goes on, he says, there's swearing, lying, murder, stealing, and committing adultery. They break all bounds, and the bloodshed follows bloodshed. These are linked to the Ten Commandments. Because in this time, what God had given them as part of their covenant relationship with him is the Ten Commandments, the laws that they are to follow. That's one of the conditions of their relationship. And they're violating them because they're lying, they're stealing, swearing. Now, swearing, okay? In this context, they're talking about, it could be a couple of things. One, swearing, like taking an oath, right? Like I swear on the Bible, or I swear on, I don't even know what. I don't think I say that. The other thing is some of your translations say cursing, okay? And that might have a different connotation for us. But then that still can go back to the Ten Commandments because one of them actually talks about what? Taking the Lord's name in vain. And so what does that actually mean? It means not swearing, right? Like in his name, and we'll see this again later. It means not taking the Lord's name in vain and using his name or his son's name outside of the context of a theological conversation. Okay? So here these are violations of the Ten Commandments that he's accusing them of, and this is what this looks like. When you are not faithful, when you don't have steadfast love, when you don't have knowledge of me, these are the things that happen. And then he goes on and he says, therefore, because these things are happening, because you are doing these things, the land mourns. There is a connection to humanity and the sinfulness of humanity, the prosperity, the stewardship of humanity, and what God has created in regards to the land and the creatures and all of those things. And here, God is making that connection. And in verse 4, he says, Yet let no one contend, let no one accuse, for with you is my contention, O priests. Well, that does mean what we think it does. He is talking about the religious leaders. He's saying, my problem is with you. But hold for a minute, okay? My problem is with you. Priests, religious leaders are held to a higher standard. Today in our conversations, a couple of people said to me, doesn't that make you anxious and nervous? Like, oh my gosh. And I said, well, yes, but I mean, yes, but I think what motivates me and my conviction that God has called me to this, I think grounds me. And I'm more fearful of being heretical and inappropriate. So I'm not as concerned about being told that I'm held to a higher standard. And so he is pointing out to the priests and the leaders because they are participating in this sinful behavior, the worship of idols. And he says, in verse 5, and I will destroy your mother. Israel is the mother. I think one of the tricky things about the language in Hosea is the use of like mothers, daughters, brides, children. Okay, in this context, he's actually talking Israel, mother as Israel. He also says in verse 6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I reject you from being a priest to me. This knowledge. What is the expectation of priests, religious leaders, in their knowledge and understanding of God? It's faithfulness, steadfast love, knowledge. It's the orthodoxy. Orthopraxy, orthopathy that we talked about. And he goes on and he says, and since you have forgotten the law of your God, I also will forget your children. And there's another word, there's another thing that makes people cringe, like, why the kids? Well, why the kids? Because listen, if I'm up here and I'm teaching something that is not appropriate and that you can worship a stick, and the fertility gods are going to grant you a plentiful harvest, and you go and do that, and I keep encouraging you to do that, you do that, your kids are watching you, your kids are here listening to me, and they're going to do the same thing. And so he's forced to, because we haven't done a good job of teaching and modeling this faithfulness, steadfast love, this knowledge of God, and what it is that he desires from us in this covenant relationship that he invites us to. And so that's the context of the generations and the consequences of our sin to the generations behind us. Then he goes on in verse 8. They feed on sin. They feed on the sin of my people, they the priests. So literally, if you sin, okay, and a priest were to say to you, if you make this sacrifice, your sin will be forgiven. You come to me with your offering, and I take your offering. Well, it's meat or harvest. And if you're sinning enough and enough people are sinning, I'm going to be eating real good. And it's a benefit to me, right? It's a benefit to the priest if the people are sinning, and I am the mediator for them to be absolved of their sin. And then if there's so much they can't consume it all and use it themselves. Well, then they might as well sell it, right? So now they're profiting. And that's what this is calling out. They feed on the sin of my people. They are greedy in their iniquity. And it shall be like people, like priests. I will punish them for the ways and repay them for their deeds. Verse 10 goes on, they shall eat but not be satisfied. They shall play the whore but not multiply, because they have forsaken the Lord to cherish whoredom, wine, and new wine, which take away the understanding. They believe that they are doing, they believe that they are making the right sacrifices. Remember that they have combined their worship of Yahweh, God, and their understanding of the covenant and the other rules or law, or parts of the law that God had given them to maintain a righteous relationship with him, and they've combined them with what they have come into with the Canaanites in this worship of Baal and the fertility gods. So they've commingled them, and they can't even tell where one ends and one starts. And they maybe can't even separate it. And so they think that all worship, they still think they're honoring God. In their minds, they're doing the right thing. But they're not going to be satisfied by them. He said that before in chapter 2, right? These were going to be the boundaries. I will dry up your fields. You will not eat. You will not reproduce. This is the consequence of their sin. In verse 12, he goes on, my people inquire of a piece of wood, and they and their walking staff gives them oracles. Now, there's some commentaries. One of them I kind of appreciated, because he's like, there's a little sass and sarcasm there. You know, seriously, you're talking to a stick? You're worshiping a stick, and you seriously think that you are going to have these abundant blessings because you worshiped this stick? Or in the previous, in chapter 3, they talked about the standing stones. Seriously? What part of this did you hear in the Ten Commandments? Because what did the Ten Commandments actually say? In your blue Bibles, in on page 61, we have in Exodus, we have a list of the Ten Commandments. They're laid out, they're addressed in chapter 4 of Hosea. 1, you shall have no other gods before me. 2, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers of the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. This explains, this came in Exodus. He's already told them, when you do this, this is what the consequence is going to be. And so we have to have this context. And then he goes on to say, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Steadfast love. Next, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold his guiltless who take the name in vain. Next, remember the Sabbath. Honor your father and your mother. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. It was pretty clearly laid out. And now again in Hosea, he's saying these were laid out, right? The faithfulness, the steadfast love, no knowledge is a sin of omission. And I know these are omitted in your relationship with me and in your life, because these are the things that are happening. These are the things that I'm seeing from you. And then he goes on in verse 12 at the end, and this one threw me. The very last statement, he says, and they left their God to play the whore. What? And that's a capital G. What has happened is that they have turned Yahweh, God, and their relationship with him to this transactional relationship. Remember a couple weeks ago, we talked about the difference between a covenant relationship and being a mutual relationship, and then a contractual type of relationship or a transactional type of relationship being one that is expectant of something in return, as far as like, I do this, you do this for me. Okay, so now they've turned God, Yahweh, into a God that is transactional, which is connected, we talked about in week one, this idea of prostitution and whoredom as a representation of this transactional relationship. He goes on in verse 13, therefore your daughters play the whore, your brides commit adultery. Some of your translations where it says brides might say your daughters-in-law commit adultery. And then he goes on. Verse 14, I will not punish your daughters when they play the whore, nor your brides when they commit adultery. Why? For the men themselves go aside with prostitutes and sacrifice with the prostitutes, and the people without understanding shall come to ruin. This is the equalizing verse, right? I think that one of the things that I really wanted to be cognizant of and careful of is that Hosea didn't somehow communicate or allow us to hold Gomer and females in this position of differentiated sin. And so this, for in my mind, verse 14, is this equalizing accusation that God makes. These priests and these fathers and these men were also going to prostitutes and paying. They were going to temples. So they talked about, people had asked a little questions about this previously, this idea of whether or not Gomer was participating in cult prostitution. So cult prostitution is this pagan worship of idols, Baalism, this idea that the priests and men would be able to have sex with specific women outside of the temple in an act of sacrifice and commitment to the fertility gods in order to be blessed with fertility or abundance in their, crops. Okay? That's what cult prostitution was. The priests were participating. The fathers and the other men were participating in this. And without them participating, there wouldn't be a need for it. And this is like, we don't have to go in circles of which came first, the chicken or the egg, because it does not matter. It does not matter. The sin is equal. The sin is the responsibility of all of us. So we can point fingers at false teachers, and we can point fingers at pastors who have fallen, but we all carry a responsibility. And I know that I have invited, I know that Eric has invited, John. If there is something that is set up here or that I say that is hit sideways for you, that doesn't match what you thought you knew to be true or bumps up against something, I want to talk to you about it. I want to hear from you. Because if we don't do that, that's where harm happens. I don't want you to talk about it with somebody else. I don't want you to talk about me with somebody else. I don't want you to leave Timberwood and talk about it somewhere else. Come in. Email me. I'd love nothing more. So we have this responsibility to understand and grow in our faith, right? I said this, one of my professors, and maybe I said this last week or the week before, or maybe I didn't. One of my professors, who I dearly loved, in her introductory video for class, she said to us, "I am giving you the best theology that I have today." And I'm like, "Whoa, wait, I'm in seminary." She's like, "I am continuing to read and research and study and understand, and my faith is also growing, and my theology is also evolving. My understanding, my faithfulness, my steadfast love, my knowledge is going deeper. And so what I have for you today is the best I've got. And if you take this same class in 2 years, it might be slightly different." And so I think all of us would say, all of us that are in teaching roles here would say, we are giving you the best we have today. And we're all continuing to grow and learn. And we all have that responsibility. So then, verse 16, he goes on and he says, "Like a stubborn heifer, Israel is stubborn. Can the Lord now feed them like a lamb in the broad pasture?" There is like this exasperation. Like, I don't know what else to say or do to get your attention. You're so stubborn, you refuse to understand. I have zero agricultural bone in my body. You might not be able to guess that just by looking at me. So I actually did a Google search, because you know that everything you can find on Google is true. But I actually typed this in. Why are heifers stubborn? And it answered me. It said, "Heifers are often considered stubborn because their natural instinct to be cautious and less easily controlled compared to steers makes them difficult to handle." Makes sense then that he would use this, because what he's like, you're not even listening, you're not willing to move, you're so stubborn. And I guess the faith that you have coming to is the faith that you have coming to you. Exasperation, frustration. And in the end, he says, "A wind has wrapped them in its wings, and they shall be ashamed because of their sacrifices," pointing to the consequence of this. He's pointing to the fall of Israel that is going to happen 20 years from now. That's the prophecy that Hosea is bringing. It's the warning of God saying, "Pay attention, people. Wake up, pay attention, repent, turn to me, restore our relationship. It doesn't have to be this way. And if you don't, this is where it will go. This is what will happen." One of the questions that came up in our discussions this after or today, were there any people that were actually faithful, showing steadfast love and knowledge of God? Were there anybody? Because this feels like really broad sweeping statements, right? Israel, like all the people. Well, the answer to that is yes, there were, because we have Daniel. Like, we did Daniel in the fall, and Daniel comes before Hosea, but we have to remember in the timeline that Daniel actually it will happen after Hosea. So if Daniel is, you know, active after this period that we're in right now, there is somebody, and his age, right? There is somebody that is faithful. There had to be people that he was watching and learning from that what it looked like to have that covenant relationship with Yahweh. And so that's the challenge that we have. What does it look like to be Daniel in a time like this? When other people, or like the teenagers or my kids say, like, everybody else is doing it, and we have this group think, like this group mentality, and we just kind of blow with wherever the wind goes, we have to be so careful about that and pay attention. And so the questions that you have in your discussion group today really talk about this idea of this sin of omission. What is missing? What is lacking in our understanding, in our love, in our faithfulness, in our covenant relationship that God invites us to? What is missing? What will bring us into that right relationship? What will allow us to move toward God? And what does that look like? And then, what are we stubborn about? What is that thing that we will just not move off of? The ideal, the thing that you argue about the most with people? Just ask yourself, why are you arguing so much about it? If you're not sure, maybe that's an opportunity for you to spend some time quiet with God, asking, contemplating. Or maybe it's an invitation, an opportunity for you to talk with somebody else about it. But I would say, if you're arguing a lot about something with somebody or people in general, that might be a clue of an idol, a stubbornness that is causing us to not be able to listen and hear and not be able to move closer to God. So those are great questions for your discussion group. Have fun with that. We'll come back. Start heading back this way, like 4 minutes too.